Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Challenge yourself as a leader and transform your career with a top-ranked MBA from Berkeley Haas. Gain access to a world-class university located in the epicenter of innovation and engage with renowned faculty, mentors, and collaborative peers. The evening and weekend MBA program delivers a robust MBA experience on your schedule. Excel in your current role while building leadership skills for what comes next. Visit haas.org/apply to start your Berkeley Haas application today.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Pixar director Domi Shi.
Oh no, maybe this is too weird and edgy for Pixar.
To hone her unique creative voice, Domi had to embrace her inner weirdo.
Combining Taoist chanting with 90s boy band music, it had to work.
On Spark and Fire, creators from different fields share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 5th of January, these are our main stories. As the war grinds on in Ukraine, we have a special report from the front lines, where ferocious fighting is taking place. Stalemate again as the US House of Representatives fails to elect a new speaker. Plus,
we continue to ask China for more rapid, reliable data on hospitalizations and deaths, as well as more comprehensive real-time viral sequencing.
The head of the World Health Organization appeals to China to come clean on COVID. Also in this podcast,
we welcome any deal that would enable the reunification of the marbles in Greece, that would allow people in Greece and other countries to see them in situ, because that would be an amazing sight.
Why the British Museum is edging closer to losing the Elgin marbles, and
there are going to be fewer people in offices for the longer term. And if there's not many places to go and have lunch or go out with your friends after work, those places are going to cease to be relevant.
Is working from home here to stay? Bakhmut in the east of Ukraine has seen some of the most fierce fighting in the country in recent days. After losing ground in other parts of Ukraine, capturing the city has become a key target for Moscow. Many civilians have left the area, but thousands of people, mostly elderly, still live among the ruins. Ogatela Mai has sent us this report from the city.
We're approaching the city of Bakhmut.
What you can see everywhere in Bakhmut, destruction. You can see apartment blocks that are completely destroyed. We're walking all over shards of glass. Pretty much every second you hear the sound of artillery fire. You can tell every minute that this is a city that is being intensely fought over. Even though it's at an important road intersection, it is the symbolic importance of this fight that has become greater than its strategic location.
We've walked into what they're calling a resilience hub here. It's essentially a centre where there's heating, there's power, a place to charge mobile phones, some food and hot drinks being distributed, medicines on the shelves around me. And all around I can see people, most of them are elderly, just sitting here trying to charge up their phones. People's faces look exhausted, they look stricken. There was one woman earlier who was just looked like she was in shock, just talking to herself. But also, when the sound is particularly loud, people don't have that much of a reaction either. It feels like they've gotten used to living with this continuous sound. According to the city's administration, only about a tenth of the population continues to live here. Why are these people still choosing to stay here? Anatoly Sushchenko is an elderly man. Wrinkles line his face.
I have nowhere to go. I'm alone. Who would want to take an 86-year-old? Here at least sometimes, when the soldiers throw away food or soup, I find it and eat it. And I get free bread. In my whole life, I've never seen anything like this.
Tetiana Sherbak used to be a midwife before the war. Now she's a volunteer. I stay because I'm needed here. Of course I'm scared. I've been caught in shelling 3 times. I suffered a concussion. But what use will I be hiding in a basement? People stay for different reasons.
The explosions don't stop.
We've just stepped out of that resilience centre out on the streets, and the sound outside much louder of the shelling, almost continuous. We're now going to go and see the mayor of this city. It's my job, my life, my fate to stay here. I won't leave the people. And I trust that Ukraine's military won't allow the city to fall, Mayor Alexei Reva told us. We're at a Ukrainian position close to Bakhmut. We watch them use Soviet-era weapons, a long gun that fires artillery. On the other side of the front line isn't just the Russian military. There are also thousands of mercenaries from the private Wagner Group. The soldiers expect incoming fire, so we retreat to a bunker, where we spoke to 21-year-old Alexander.
Why does it feel like it's deadlocked on the ground?
It's stuck for many reasons. The winter makes it harder to use equipment. We also have a shortage of weapons and ammunition. Then, back to positions they go.
Yogitil Amai in Bakhmut, in Ukraine. In the US, the deadlock in the House of Representatives over the next speaker is fast becoming a political drama because politicians can't agree on the successor to Nancy Pelosi in the role. The leading candidate is the Republican Kevin McCarthy, who needs 218 votes in his favour. As we record this podcast, he's failed to get sufficient backing in 6 rounds of voting that have already taken place. His opposition is coming from a small number of Republicans on the right of the party. One of them is the Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert.
Let's stop with the campaign smears and tactics to get people to turn against us, even having my favorite president call us and tell us we need to knock this off. I think it actually needs to be reversed. The president needs to tell Kevin McCarthy that, sir, you do not have the votes and it's time to withdraw. And with that, I yield. Thank you.
Our North American correspondent Will Grant gave us the latest from Capitol Hill.
It doesn't really look at this stage that any major concessions, any major changes have happened. Perhaps during the period of adjournment, they can actually come up with a strategy to deal with this, because the longer it goes on, the less clear the path out of it all. I mean, clearly it seems that neither Mr. McCarthy nor his critics in the Republican Party are prepared to step down. You can see increasingly that kind of high-ranking members of the Republican Party are getting more and more frustrated with this holdout group, blaming them for the impasse in general. And of course, they are blaming Mr. McCarthy, saying that he has never been their candidate. They refuse to accept him. They don't want him personally. They don't want him politically. And unless something significant changes, this will just rumble on and on.
Do we know what concessions they want from Kevin McCarthy which might make them vote for him?
Well, he has already given quite a few away. They include things like changing the rules so that a group of just 5 Republican Congress people can bring a vote, can force a vote of no confidence in the Speaker's chair, or essentially attempt to remove him from the chair. Well, one of those who's holding out against Mr. McCarthy wants that reduced to a single congressperson's right to be able to bring that vote of no confidence. That would obviously be a very, very low threshold. Unlikely that that concession will be made. Other things relate to, for example, who will sit on what committee as chair or chairperson.
Is there anything in the rules that says after 10, 15, 20 votes, they have to find another way? Or could this just go on interminably, it seems?
It seems that it could. I mean, the last time it happened was a century ago. That was 9 votes and several days before it was resolved. Before that, in 1856, it went on for 2 months and 133 votes. So, I mean, you know, there is precedent set there for this to go on for as long as it takes. I think you're right, though. Ultimately, kind of convention suggests that they need to find a means around this. It's just almost turned turning into the ultimate game of political chicken. You know, which side will blink first? Will it be Mr. McCarthy and his supporters who accept that he simply doesn't have the votes and he's not about to get them? Or will it be the kind of holdout right-wing element of the party who decide, well, actually, they can either work with the concessions made by Mr. McCarthy's camp or hold out for a different candidate altogether?
Will Grant. The World Health Organization is seeking more details from China about the surge in COVID infections in the country. Reports indicate that hospitals are under pressure, but Beijing has limited sharing of information. The head of the WHO is Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
We continue to ask China for more rapid, regular, reliable data on hospitalizations and deaths, as well as more comprehensive real-time viral sequencing. WHO is concerned about the risk to life in China and has reiterated the importance of vaccination, including booster doses to protect against hospitalization, severe disease and death.
Our Geneva correspondent Imogen Folks told us more about what Dr. Ghebreyesus has been saying.
He was quite surprisingly firm in a way that he isn't always. He said that the circulation of COVID was and the risk to life was a real concern and that data was really not forthcoming and that this was regrettable. They wanted more. They have had some, but it hasn't been enough. And then, of course, some of his own officials, Dr. Mike Ryan in particular, he's head of health emergencies, he basically said the data, certainly on hospitalizations and deaths, he felt was a real underestimate and that China's definition of what is actually a death from COVID was far too narrow.
Yes, because official statistics from China are showing what? Just 5 new COVID deaths in 24 hours for the whole of China on Tuesday. What does the WHO know about what's going on in China?
One of the things that Dr. Mike Ryan said was kind of diplomatic, but you can understand what he's meaning. He says that doctors and nurses, he gave us the impression he thinks they're very limited in how they can say, OK, this patient died of COVID, because China's definition is very, very narrow. And that perhaps although a doctor or a nurse knows this patient, actually the real cause of death is COVID, can't say so. You get the impression that he feels that, you know, there is pressure being put on health professionals in China to underreport and that people really need to be able to say, look, this is what my patient died of.
So the WHO, very concerned about what's going on in China. Are they also concerned about the impact of that on other countries?
Interestingly, the WHO is often very reluctant to support swinging travel restrictions. Now, we haven't seen really strict travel restrictions related to China at the moment, but the head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, he said it was perfectly understandable that countries would be taking measures to protect their own citizens. And what he's meaning is the moves by the United States, some European countries, to ask for mandatory testing. And China, of course, has dismissed this as discriminatory. But the WHO were actually backing the other countries today and saying, no, this is understandable, particularly because we just don't have enough information yet from China.
Imogen Folks. Well, meanwhile, a new COVID variant appears to be the most infectious yet, according to the World Health Organization. Named XBB.1.5, it's spread rapidly across the US. But there's no evidence that it's more severe than previous variants, as our medical editor Fergus Walsh explains.
Within the space of a month, XBB.1.5 has become the dominant COVID variant in the United States, accounting for around 40% of cases. It's an offshoot of Omicron and has mutations which help it evade immune defences. Dr. Maria van Kerkhove of the World Health Organization said it had a growth advantage above all other subvariants. Scientists think it's likely XBB.1.5 will spread globally. Last month, it accounted for around 1 in 25 cases in the UK. Professor Wendy Barclay, a virologist at Imperial College London, said there was no suggestion the variant would be able to bypass the protection against severe illness afforded by vaccines. But she was concerned about the vulnerable who have less immunity to coronavirus. The UK had 5 COVID waves last year, and the new variant could fuel the first of 2023.
Fergus Walsh. There seems to have been a dramatic shift over the issue of repatriation of foreign artefacts from British museums. The once unthinkable is becoming the quite likely, most notably in the case of the Parthenon sculptures, once referred to as the Elgin Marbles. Acquired by Lord Elgin at the beginning of the 19th century, they found their way to the British Museum. But it seems a deal may be in sight to return them to Greece. Evan Davis spoke to the director of the Museums Association, Sharon Hill.
There is, as described by the British Museum, a constructive dialogue underway, and it has been underway for some time. And I think it's really interesting because if you've ever been to the Parthenon Museum in Athens, you can see the gaps where they should be. So at the Museums Association, we would say we welcome any deal that's on the table that would enable the reunification of the marbles in Greece, that would allow people in Greece and other countries to see them in situ, because that would be an amazing sight for people. And other countries have already returned. So the Vatican has already given back 3 Parthenon sculptures. It shows it's possible to do it. And ethically, we'd say it's the right thing to do to get into this conversation, this dialogue.
This is not where we were 20 years ago, really, which was rather defensive lines about how there was no reason that they need to go back to Greece.
Yes, and I think there has been really a sea change in attitudes. There was a danger 3 or 4 years ago that the UK was being left behind compared to Europe and other countries. And now we're seeing ongoing discussion about restitution and repatriation. We're seeing real action from the first time from big national institutions in this country. And it's not just the Parthenon marbles. You know, we've seen action around the Benin bronzes being returned to Nigeria from the University of Aberdeen, from the Horniman Museum in London, and from other institutions. And again, not just the Benin bronzes, from the Royal Albert Memorial Museum, handing back ceremonial items to First Nation tribes, to National Museums Northern Ireland, returning objects to Hawaii. So there's been real proactive conversation and dialogue that's led to action and to return. And we think ethically that's the right thing to do. The general approach should be an open and respectful dialogue so that looted items in particular, or items that were forcibly traded, can be unconditionally returned. And we do mean unconditionally returned. It's up to the source and origin communities to decide what happens to them next.
Are we going to have empty museums if we do that, though? I mean, how much of our museum stock is going to be sent away?
If you don't mind me saying so, that's a bit of a red herring, because museums have millions of objects. They're never going to be short of things to display. In a lot of museums, they have a lot of stuff in storage that might come out for exhibitions or loans or displays or research. But museums are not going to be short of items for display. And if they give some things back, they might end up with more, because you'll have a better relationship with those countries. Yeah. What's not to say that Greece now won't loan other items to museums in the UK for the UK public to enjoy?
The director of the Museums Association, Sharon Hill. Still to come in the Global News podcast, will Pope Francis call it a day?
I think that Pope Francis will continue in this ministry as long as he believes and sees that he is capable.
In a further sign of its dramatic decline, Lebanon has been named the 6th worst country in the world that's experiencing a food crisis, putting it in the company of Yemen, Haiti and Afghanistan. That's according to the charity Save the Children. The organisation is also warning that the number of children at a crisis level of hunger is projected to rise by 14% this year unless urgent action is taken. Reddy Labi spoke to Save the Children's Fidel Saad and began by asking about Lebanon's food security.
The number of children suffering from food insecurity is likely to increase by 14%, but also the number of families suffering from food insecurity is likely to increase. To date, we know that 2.26 million Lebanese and Syrian refugee households in Lebanon are suffering from high food insecurity, whereas 350 residents in Lebanon are suffering from severe food insecurity, which means that those families are not able to meet their food needs, not able to maintain a certain level of dignity when it comes to their dietary diversity as well. But it also has lots of implications on children, including an increase in malnutrition for children, which affects their cognitive capacities and also learning abilities.
What has happened that has led to Lebanon becoming the sixth worst country in the world experiencing a food crisis? I mean, we know there's been some political instability for a number of years now, but what actually got us here?
You know, when we hear about the crisis in Lebanon, we give reference to October 2019. But things had been accumulating for almost 30 years before October 2019, including economic and financial mismanagement and neglect on various sectors such as the social infrastructure, health sectors, and many more. So in summer 2019, depositors with important cash flows were struggling to withdraw large amounts of USD from the banks, while the dollars and the Lebanese lira were interchangeably trading in Lebanon, which prided itself on its strong banking sector. But once the USD dried up and the local currency started to slowly slip for the first time since it was pegged to the dollar in 1997, today, before we had this interview, I was looking at the black market parallel, or at the parallel rate, which was trading at 42,000 Lebanese lira, which means that the currency has lost nearly 95% of its value. Mm-hmm. But what does this also mean? The minimum wage in Lebanon was at 675,000 Lebanese lira, which was almost $450. In May 2022, the minimum wage was updated to 1,330 USD at the official rate, but $40 at the black market rate. So, which places Lebanon among the top 10 countries with the lowest incomes.
How is the government responding? What have they said about these figures?
What we are trying to do as international organizations is to advocate with the government for increased social protection, specifically those related to children, child-centered social protection, so that those families have access to a certain level of income and they can live in dignity to meet their basic needs.
Fidel Saad from Save the Children in Lebanon, speaking there to Reddy Tlabi. The doors of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican closed on Wednesday night to mark the end of the public lying in state of Pope Benedict, who died on New Year's Eve. His death brought to an end the unusual situation of having two living popes. As our religion editor Ali Makbul reports, Benedict's death has raised questions about whether Pope Francis, who has health concerns, may now be considering his resignation.
By the end of tomorrow, there will, for the first time in nearly a decade, be just one pope at the Vatican again. So what's it been like for the current pontiff to have had the previous incumbent here too? We asked one of those closest to Pope Francis, his foreign secretary, Archbishop Paul Gallagher.
It does have an effect. There's a presence there, which is undeniable. I don't think it's obstructed Pope Francis in any way. He's done and said and decided what he wanted to do. But it's a powerful presence of your predecessor. I think most of us have been in the situations where there's a bit of a shadow from our predecessor.
In recent months, Pope Francis has struggled with mobility. There was speculation he was reluctant to think about resigning while Pope Benedict was around, and that he might now consider that option more freely.
If we had three popes, that would be a little bit difficult to manage, I would say. But now that Pope Benedict has gone to the Lord, I think that, yes, Pope Francis will stick to those principles that he's established, that he will continue in this ministry as long as he believes and sees that he is capable.
Archbishop Gallagher says the two had an excellent relationship. That's likely to shine through as Pope Francis prepares for an unprecedented event, a current pope presiding over the funeral of the predecessor that stepped down.
Ali Makbul. The top Iranian actor, Taraneh Al-Dusti, has been released from prison after her friends and family provided bail. She was arrested last month for issuing statements of support for the women's movement in Iran following demonstrations triggered by the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. Those protests have escalated into widespread calls for the overthrow of clerical rule. Taraneh Stone of BBC Persian has been following the story.
While she was released on bail, her mother posted on Instagram that she's going to be released shortly. And after that, we saw pictures on social media and some pictures that we received that she had her headscarf down just fresh out of prison, which a lot of people on social media thought that was very brave considering that she was in prison for almost 3 weeks. She was holding a bouquet of flowers, she was smiling, and she was surrounded by loads of prominent actors like herself who campaigned for her release during her arrest.
Has there been a lot of attention on this? Because she's well known, isn't she, in Iran?
She's one of the most famous actors in Iran, if not the most famous actress. She's best known for her role in the Oscar-winning The Salesman. And she's played in many, many different movies and series. And she's really well known. She's very well known outside Iran as well. And that's why a lot of actors and a lot of artists across the world campaigned for her release as well.
And remind us about the circumstances around her arrest.
It was about 18 days ago that her house was raided and she was arrested. Prior to that, she released a photo of herself without her headscarf on social media, and she was holding a poster with Woman, Life, Freedom slogan on it. That went viral very quickly. And a while after that, she was arrested for inciting chaos.
And obviously this is going on with the background of protests. Are they continuing in Iran?
They are happening in Iran still. It seems to have calmed down a little bit in general. But a lot of people say that this is not the end of it and nothing will go back to normal.
Taraneh Stone. For millions of office workers around the world, the biggest plus to emerge from the pandemic has been spending more time working from home. Even after lockdowns ended, people wondered if it would last. Well, research here shows that in the UK, a shorter office week of Tuesday to Thursday is becoming the norm, and that's drawing people out of the big urban centres to smaller towns and cities. David Sillitoe has been to one unlikely hotspot in southwest England.
Welcome to Budleigh Salterton, and this is the Longboat Cafe, and Matt and the rest of the staff here are going to be doing something this year for the first time ever. They're going to be staying open through the winter.
So last year we were open for the week after Christmas, and it was just as busy as it was in the height of summer.
And here on the high street, something remarkable. No empty shops. And when it comes to the housing market, estate agents would describe it as buoyant. Budleigh used to be a place to retire to, but for some it's become something of a working from home hotspot. And I met two relatively recent arrivals, Adam Sweet, who's a structural engineer, and Mark Godfrey, who runs a wedding venue.
We're very lucky to find our dream home in Budleigh during COVID.
How often do you have to go into the office?
Twice a week probably now, and the rest of it I just do from home.
There's sort of 10, 20 families that have all moved in. It's become quite a family-friendly area.
Life has been transformed, hasn't it?
Oh, totally, totally transformed.
And now we have some interesting data. A study based on mobile phone data, a footfall of more than 500 places around the country by Trump Chatcot, the firm Placemake. City centres in 2022 are down on 2019, the City of London by more than 50%, but many smaller neighbourhoods, commuter towns, suburbs with local shops and old-fashioned towns like Budleigh have, according to this analysis, got busier in this new era of working from home. I'm standing here in the heart of the City of London at the moment. It's Friday, it's just after 5 o'clock, and while I'm not entirely alone, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say this was a rush hour. Mark Allen of the property firm Landsec says the office industry has now accepted there is a new working week.
What we see is Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, incredibly busy. Mondays, 50 to 60% of those days. Friday is almost like another weekend day. We certainly believe that there are going to be fewer people in offices for the longer term, and we're planning accordingly.
Employers are going to have to try and create offices that actually will attract their own employees in.
Completely. And if there's not many places to go and have lunch or go out with your friends after work, I think those places are going to cease to be relevant in their current form.
Of course, for many of us, life has just returned to normal. But for a privileged few, the office is now a place we go to when we want to, rather than when we have to.
David Sillitoe. And finally, one of Britain's most prolific writers, Faye Weldon, has died at the age of 91. Her stories, mainly of women and their fraught relationships with men, have become bestsellers around the world in a career spanning more than five decades. Our arts correspondent, Rebecca Jones, looks back at her life.
You'd better keep that.
But it's your wedding ring.
The life and loves of a she-devil, in which a woman takes Machiavellian revenge on her unfaithful husband and his lover.
Let's go to bed.
It was adapted from Faye Weldon's novel.
Yes.
She has a new lover.
And cemented her reputation as one of Britain's foremost feminist writers.
She cat on heat.
She grew up in New Zealand. A portrait of Faye and her sister hangs in the country's National Gallery. Faye came to Britain at 15.
Now, nobody has understood this. We failed miserably.
She first made her name as an advertising copywriter. Go to work on an egg was one of hers. She later claimed her advertising success was down to luck. After marrying Ron Weldon, she began writing TV plays and novels when pregnant.
Amazing how one unseen person can do so much to spoil a life.
She wrote about many things, including the supernatural.
Hattie, you are clumsy.
I am not clumsy. It did it by itself. And don't call me Hattie.
Blame it on her condition.
Typically, she wrote playful, punchy tales in which women were exploited by men, though they often got their own back. Puffball, one of her best novels, later became a film. By the end of her life, society's views of women's role had changed dramatically.
It wasn't just feminism that changed things. It was technology, it was birth control, it was all kinds of other factors. I mean, sometimes I think feminism was just a sort of cloak under which capitalism sort of crept up in us all and turned us into a consumer society and made us all go out to work and exhaust for this.
Later in life, some feminists thought Faye Weldon was a traitor to the cause, who urged women to pick up their husband's socks. She felt her job was done. What drove me to feminism 50 years ago was the myth that men were the breadwinners and women kept house and looked pretty, she wrote. That myth finally exploded, and I helped to explode it.
Rebecca Jones on the life of Faye Weldon, who's died at the age of 91. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Challenge yourself as a leader and transform your career with a top-ranked MBA from Berkeley Haas. Gain access to a world-class university located in the epicenter of innovation and engage with renowned faculty, mentors, and collaborative peers. The evening and weekend MBA program delivers a robust MBA experience on your schedule. Excel in your current role while building leadership skills for what comes next. Visit haas.org/apply to start your Berkeley Haas application today.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Pixar director Domi Shih.
Oh no, maybe this is too weird and edgy for Pixar.
To hone her unique creative voice, Domi had to embrace her inner weirdo.
Combining Taoist chanting with 90s boy band music, it had to work.
On Spark and Fire, creators from different fields share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.